Today was one of those days in the market where if you have an investment account, you might just not want to look. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, June 13th. Good to have you with us. While, yes, there was plenty happening on Capitol Hill today, and those January 6th Select Committee hearings are important, our focus today, the happenings on Wall Street, where the markets had a pretty lousy day. The major indices continued their sell-off, and the S&P 500 has fallen over 20% from where it was in January, meaning the index has entered bear market territory. All of that is connected to another big news item this week, the meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, where they will raise interest rates in an effort to rein in inflation. To connect all these dots, we called up Gina Smilek at the New York Times, also one of our Friday regulars. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
Gina, why does it matter, this idea of us being in a bear market?
It matters in the sense that it just illustrates how extremely sour sentiment has suddenly become. You know, we went from really feeling pretty good about an economy that has extremely low unemployment, very rapid wage growth, to really feeling very negative about it pretty quickly here. And that is all kind of comes back to extremely high inflation and the Fed's efforts to quash that extremely high inflation.
Yeah, and who is the we feeling bad about the economy? Are we talking consumers? Are we talking businesses? Are we talking everybody?
I think we're talking pretty much everybody here. So if you look at consumer sentiment data, the University of Michigan Index, which is a very closely watched one, plunged to the lowest level on record in preliminary data released last week. If you look at business surveys, you know, small businesses are feeling really negative right now. If you look at surveys of economists, they are increasingly marking up their chances of a recession. You know, even the optimists who have long been saying, you know, the Fed could probably pull this off with a soft landing after last Friday's inflation report, which came in very hot, acknowledged that, you know, actually this might be pretty difficult to achieve. And so I think it is just across the board, everyone is feeling pretty bad right now.
Speaking of the Fed, part of this sell-off today was this rising sense, and then later some analysts saying so and some reporting coming out that the Fed was going to do a 75 basis point rate hike this week instead of the 50 that a lot of folks were expecting. What does that shift tell you?
I think that the watchword for this year from the Fed has really been nimble. And I think that the Fed was expecting to make a half point increase at this meeting before they got all that horrendous data I just talked about. And they basically predicated that half point increase on the idea that the data were going to come in as they expected. Well, the data have done anything but come in as they expected. And so, you know, we're shaping up for potentially a bigger rate increase. Certainly, it seems like it's going to be on the table for discussion. And I think that what that tells you is the Fed is, you know, getting pretty serious about trying to bring inflation under control and get this situation back to some semblance of price stability.
You know, when they first started this series of rate hikes, people were expecting that Powell would go for several 50 basis point rate hikes, one after another after another. Now people are talking about several 75 basis point rate hikes moving forward. What's feeding into this and what does that mean for our ability to slow down this economy?
Yeah, well, I think it is probably pretty important to note that they've been, you know, they have really emphasized this idea of nimbleness. So I think it's probably too early for us to know if they're going to do multiple 75 basis point increases, just because we haven't heard them talk about that yet. And we obviously have a lot of data before they'll have to make another decision. And so I think that's important. But I do think that, you know, I think that thing it tells us is that they're very nervous about price increases and that they are very likely to slow the economy sharply in an effort to get them to come down. You know, I think we were aiming for a soft or a softish landing, but that is becoming increasingly unlikely because it seems clear that price increases are very broad, very, you know, persistent, much more stubborn than anybody expected. And the Fed is coming around to the idea that they might have to cause a little bit of pain to bring them down.
In a few seconds we have left, what is Jerome Powell thinking?
Jerome Powell is probably thinking he wishes that Friday inflation report never happened, I imagine. But, you know, far be it for me to say what the Fed chair thinks in his mind.
Gina Smilek at the New York Times, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
On Wall Street today, well, we kind of just talked about that, but it'll be the Wawas for sure when we do the numbers. So like Gina and I were just discussing, markets and business journalists are watching the Fed this week. And the Fed is watching, among other things, that inflation we were also just talking about. The consumer price index data we got on Friday was a big downer, with inflation at 8.6%, one of the biggest jumps in prices that we've seen in decades. So if the Fed's efforts to slow the economy work, prices will eventually stabilize. But then what? Marketplace's Christian Schwab looks at what kind of economy we'll be left with.
When policymakers talk about bringing inflation down, they're talking about slowing the rate of climbing prices, not reducing the actual price of goods and services. Laura Veldkamp is an economist at Columbia University.
So it's kind of like the car is slowing down, but we're not throwing the car into reverse.
Usually when prices go up, they stay up. That's because industries, consumers, and wages adjust to make up for lost spending power. That last part, wage growth, has been slowing. Dean Baker, an economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, says wages are why he thinks some prices will go down. Also, partly because the reasons behind these hikes vary.
Clearly, there are different stories with different items.
One case study, inflation for appliances and furniture could slow now that retailers are overstocked. Other temporary issues include the war in Ukraine, a lingering semiconductor shortage, and shipping delays. But some essentials, like housing and food, will take longer to adjust. Jason Lusk, a food and agricultural economist at Purdue, says, remember, you can't speed up nature. That's why meat prices are so volatile, up 14% from a year ago.
It's bad in the sense that when prices rise, as consumers, we pay more of that. On the flip side, it's good because when prices fall, we see more of those savings as consumers for meat products.
Because producers will step up to meet demand. It's just a matter of how long that takes and how long consumers can hang on. Lusk's department recently conducted a survey asking families how rising prices have influenced their food shopping habits.
And the most common response was, I haven't changed anything.
Usually, the food industry measures how stressed people's budgets are by noting changes in what cuts of meat or what brands they're buying. He says shoppers aren't behaving like they're in a recession yet. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
As I said at the top of the show, we have had a busy day here in Washington with the ongoing January 6th hearings, Supreme Court rulings, and, it seems, some actual forward movement on gun control. Over the weekend, a bipartisan group of 20 senators announced a deal on a framework for legislation, which, if it crosses the finish line, would be the biggest expansion of federal gun control law since 1994. So to go over what is and isn't in this framework, we called up Cassandra Crafasi. She is a professor and deputy director at the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. Dr. Crafasi, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So all we have is a broad outline of this legislation at this point, or pending legislation. What's your initial reaction?
I think the framework does a nice job of addressing multiple facets of the issue. Gun violence is a complicated problem, and it's not going to be solved with just one strategy. So I appreciated that the framework did try to touch on a few different elements.
Last time we spoke, you said some of the low-hanging fruit in terms of reducing gun violence was expanding background checks. What does this package do in regards to that?
Yeah, this framework touches on two pieces that I think are relevant for background checks. The first is better defining who is a licensed dealer, which is really important because under federal law, you're only required to undergo a background check if you buy a gun from a licensed dealer. So better defining who's engaged in the business of selling guns may make more folks who are buying them subject to the background check system that exists. The second piece is an enhanced background check for people under the age of 21 who are buying guns. This involves an investigative period to look at criminal history and mental health records and is facilitated by state and local records that might not yet have been reported into the federal system.
You mentioned mental health. There's quite a bit of new mental health funding that this proposal lays out. Where would that go?
I think it's important that we are approaching this issue from a multifaceted framework. So we need to be thinking about supportive services, funding for mental health resources, both in school and out of schools through telemedicine. So this is a really important focus, but I think a real missed opportunity in this framework, also related to background checks, is not closing the default proceed loophole. They decided to not address the 3 days that are allowed for law enforcement to conduct a background check and move it to 10. They decided to keep it at 3, which is, I think, a real missed opportunity.
And that default proceed loophole means if the FBI doesn't respond to a background check within 3 days, the sale can just go ahead without any additional scrutiny.
Correct. And so our default is to sell a firearm in the absence of complete information. And then if a background check comes back later and that person is prohibited, somebody has to go and take the firearms away from the person who never should have had them in the first place. And it creates a real gap where around 5,000 people every year legally acquire guns who never should have been allowed to get one.
It does close some loopholes, though, including the boyfriend loophole. How does it approach that?
It does. A really important gap in prior law did not apply domestic violence prohibitions to people who had dated but not lived together. So this framework does extend those prohibitions to dating partners, which is really important because perpetrators of domestic violence and intimate partner violence don't have to have lived with someone to be a significant threat.
What do you think this will actually do to gun sales in this country moving forward?
I honestly don't know that it would do much to deter firearm sales. If anything, you may see more people buying firearms because of broader concerns that more might be done. But I'm hopeful that this signals progress, that we can come together as a country and put some reasonable policies in place that can help people see passing national legislation does not mean that we're going to take everybody's guns away.
Cassandra Crafassi is a professor and deputy director at the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up,
to make sustainability simple and accessible for people.
Sounds like a plan, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 876 points, almost 2.8% to end at 30,516. The Nasdaq slid 530 points, about 4.7% to close at 10,809. And the S&P 500 dropped 151 points, about 3.9% to finish at 3749. And we just heard Kristen talk about food prices being some of the hardest hit by inflation. Some grocery stocks, Albertsons down 4%, Kroger lost 1.5%. In the health sector, the FDA says 3 doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine appear to be effective in children under 5. Pfizer lost 4.1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.38%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI?
I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Startups are all about entrepreneurs. After all, they're the ones out there selling their ideas or product to customers and investors. And it can be tough to break into the startup world, especially in the potentially lucrative tech sector, even more so if you come from a marginalized group. According to a 2020 study by global managing consulting firm McKinsey & Company, just 4% of businesses owned by Black Americans survive the startup stage, even though 20% of Black Americans start businesses. Catherine Finney is the founder and CEO of Genius Guild and the author of the book Build the Damn Thing: How to Start a Successful Business If You're Not a Rich White Guy. And we talked about how startup culture ends up being kind of synonymous with tech culture.
It really comes from this sense of technology allows you to build things faster, quicker, and cheaper. For those of us who can remember the early 2000s, you couldn't build a website unless you knew how to code. You had to work with a website builder, right? A web developer. Now you have what we call no code or low code solutions where you can just go and the coding is already done for you. All you have to do is have great pictures of whatever product you're selling and you could be online running an online store within minutes. So those barriers are just not there anymore. And technology removed that.
In your book, you lay out the differences between a typical small business and a startup. And one of them is that they have different long-term goals. Can you explain that?
A traditional startup is really looking to get a positive event, which is usually an exit. An exit meaning either it sells to a larger company or another company, or it lists itself as an IPO, as an initial public offering on the stock exchange. Because you have people like myself, investors, who want to get our capital back. When you are a traditional small business, you may not want to sell your company at some point. You may want to create a legacy for your family members. You may not want to be pressured for growth. When you're a startup, you want to grow and you want to grow fast and quick.
Can you talk about your own experience entering the world of tech entrepreneurship?
I was a Yale-trained epidemiologist, was traveling around the world, had a fabulous closet and a fabulous amount of debt, and started a blog to talk about budget shopping because I was forced to budget shop. And this blog became a thing. It became a company. It became a media company. And it was while doing the Budget Fashionista that I wanted to do a sort of consumer product company. Black women purchase approximately over 40% of all hair care products in the United States. So this was a market that was just ripe for disruption. And I entered into one of the early incubator programs in New York City. In this incubator program of about 45 folks, four were women, and I was the only person of any sort of skin color in this incubator program. And I got up and I pitched my idea, and the mentors gave me incredible feedback, such positive feedback. But when the questions turned to the audience, it was a completely different tone. One person said to me he didn't believe that I could relate to other Black women. He was a white guy. And of course, I said, do tell, you know, maybe he had some different insight. And he said, because you have an accountant. And I took that experience with me. And I later built an organization called Digital Undivided that really works to empower Black and Latinx women to own their work. And all of that kind of led to the book. And everything that I've learned, I put in this book. It's the mentor I wish I had.
In your experience in the world of startups, what are some of the key things that you've seen limiting diversity in the tech industry?
One is this concept of networks. Most investors, most of my colleagues are actually a little bit lazy and tend to look to their own networks for investment. And so that limits the opportunities, the companies that you get to see. And that limits who you invest in. And as a result, your portfolios become concentrated with a certain group of people. I think also, for a long time, it used to be that people did not think you could build any company unless you were in San Francisco. And that, of course, has changed. But for a long time, it was a lot of pressure that you had to live there. And that made it really difficult for not just people of color and women, but anyone who didn't have a lot of money, because it's so expensive to live there, to be able to move and to be able to be taken seriously in this space.
Catherine Finney is author of the new book, Build the Damn Thing, How to Start a Successful Business If You're Not a Rich White Guy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A big chunk of the country is dealing with a major heat wave right now and using a lot more energy to keep cool, which doesn't exactly help when it comes to the climate crisis. But a lot of folks are doing what they can to reduce their own carbon footprint, leaning into that first part of the reduce, reuse, recycle triad. Emily Jones of WABE and Grist reports on the movement to reduce plastic waste by letting people refill their used containers.
Outside a Savannah, Georgia apartment building next to a food truck serving up po' boys is a small box truck emblazoned with green leaves.
Yeah, so we're all sustainable things. So LifeFit's kind of, we just help you kind of transition out of plastic.
Okay.
The truck belongs to Lightfoot Company, which owner Katie Rogers Hubbard calls a refillery. Inside, there's a wall of big pump bottles.
But yeah, we weigh the containers before and after, and then everything's just by ounce. So you can get a little bit, you can get a lot.
That way, when customers need new shampoo or face wash or dish soap, instead of throwing out the old plastic bottle and buying a new one, they can just refill it. Refilling a 16-ounce bottle with shampoo costs just over $19. Rogers Hubbard takes her refillery truck to local farmers markets and food truck events. And the idea seems to be taking hold. After just over a year in business, she's getting ready to open a brick-and-mortar store. There, she plans to offer workshops on other sustainable practices, like composting and mending clothes, instead of throwing them out.
My whole goal is to make sustainability simple and accessible for people.
That's the appeal for customer Samantha Keogh, who says she's glad to find a local shop to help her reuse plastic bottles instead of ordering plastic-free products online that then have to be shipped from far away.
Bringing in products from elsewhere just has such a big carbon impact and everything.
Single-use plastic has a huge carbon footprint, too. Rogers Hubbard says using less helps reduce the use of fossil fuels like gas and oil that make climate change worse.
There's so much fossil fuel that goes into the production and then also the recycling of plastic. And so our goal should be to use things that are meant to last.
This isn't exactly a new idea. People used to be able to get glass Coca-Cola bottles refilled at the grocery store. But it's having a resurgence as people look for ways to act on climate change. And plastic does play a big part in warming the planet, says Jessica Wall of Environment Georgia.
On our current trajectory, by 2030, plastic production will be responsible for the same amount of climate warming pollution as 295 coal-fired power plants.
To help people reduce their plastic use, stores around the country are adopting the refillery model, including sustainable beauty shop Fig and Flower in Atlanta. Owner Rachel Taylor says this does more than cut down carbon use.
So we have all this plastic going into the ocean, and then you have microplastics. So by just keeping your bottle and reusing it over and over and over again, you're just not putting as much plastic out there.
In the grand scheme of a global crisis, individuals and small businesses reusing and refilling containers is just one step. But Rogers Hubbard says she hopes this business model can influence others.
Every decision you make, the things that you spend money on, send messages to the people who are producing it.
She says there's a clear market for more sustainable products, and that should be an incentive for other companies to get on board. In Savannah, Georgia, I'm Emily Jones for Marketplace.
this final note on the way out today. As Dr. Crafassi was saying earlier, reducing gun violence in this country is going to take a lot more than Congress. Today, a new pledge from Hollywood. In partnership with the Brady Campaign to End Gun Violence, more than 200 producers, writers, and directors, including Shonda Rhimes, J.J. Abrams, and Mark Ruffalo, signed on to an open letter promising to model gun safety on screen. That means showing characters locking up guns, limiting scenes with guns and kids, and having at least one conversation pre-production about whether the film or show really needs guns at all. Here's your moment of economic context. There was red pretty much everywhere in the market today, including the continuing collapse of several cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin was down below $25,000, the lowest since December of 2020, according to CoinDesk, and Ethereum was down 17%. Over the weekend, cryptocurrency lender Celsius Network blocked customers from withdrawals or transfers due to extreme market conditions, they said. Which may be putting it a little mildly. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.